Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5227, Calvin Ki Sun Kim et al. Appellants versus United States of America et al. Mr. Drennan for appellants, Ms. Wolfinger for appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Joseph Peter Drennan on behalf of the Kims, appellants in this case. Your Honors, I'm very new to this case, but I'm prepared to state the Kims' positions here. Your Honors, first, with regard to the claims that were brought, there is no Bivens claim against the United States. We concede that. None has been intended to be brought. With regard to the Bivens claims being pled in tandem with claims under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, the Section 7433 claims, the only reason that those Bivens claims are brought, Your Honors, is because of what we believe is an incorrectly decided case that the government relies on, the Judicial Watch case out of the Fourth Circuit, the 2003 case in which the Fourth Circuit delimited the civil remedy available under 7433 to the actions of the Internal Revenue Service and its agents in respect of collection of taxes.
Counsel, the Fourth Circuit relied heavily on one snippet of legislative history, and I understand you're coming into this late, but since the act was actually a sort of populist move, I was wondering if there was legislative history to the contrary, giving collection sort of meaning that it has among ordinary people as opposed to tax experts.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the court's question. I would hearken to the Anti-Injunction Act and the way that that act has been construed, in which that act has been construed as embracing all activity that culminates in the assessment or collection of taxes.
What's the language? Because the language for 7433 is definitely in regard to collection, and it's in a structure where substantial distinctions are drawn between assessment and collection.
That is true enough, Your Honor.
If you give it a sort of popular meaning as opposed to the technical meaning, and I'm not sure if you have any basis for giving it the popular meaning.
Well, Your Honor, our basis for the ascribing the popular meaning to that can be found in the language of the statute itself, where it refers, and the court can indulge me very briefly. The statute addresses any provision of the code, if my memory serves me correct, and
I'm
fumbling here. And
you're only after the introductory line, if in connection with any collection of federal tax.
I understand that, Your Honor, but why query as to why the corresponding interpretation that's lent in the anti Injunction Act ought not to apply
That's
here.
That's why I asked you about the language of the Anti-Injunction Act. I mean, if it's parallel and has been broadly construed, then fine.
I believe that it is parallel and it does reference collection. I must say I'm handicapped not to be conversant in the precise phraseology of the statute. But I would dare say that the Anti-Injunction Act specifically addresses collection, and yet, in respect of the way in which that act has been interpreted, that act has been interpreted as encompassing all antecedent actions of the service that culminate in collection, and so. If the Congress had intended strictly to delimit 7433 to collection only, then we respectfully submit that it would have stated thus, and the language doesn't really quite go to that extent. It doesn't circumscribe it expressly. And nor should this court, we would respectfully submit.
Can I ask a question? Was a lien ever placed on the Kim's property? Count 19 claims is based on a claimed violation of Section 6301, the failure to develop notice and review procedures for liens. But it wasn't. But there's nothing in the complaint is said about a lien being.
My understanding is that the pleadings notwithstanding, that a lien was.
Well, how are we supposed to know that? Pleadings notwithstanding.
I understand, Your Honor, and yeah. Again, that's. I understand. The record is what it is, and I apologize for making that representation.
Boilerplate complaints don't help much and don't lend, at least to this judge, a sense of seriousness of purpose when a litigant comes before us. That's not very helpful.
Well, Your Honor, I can say in that regard is that these complainants brought their case pro se, and they have not had the benefit of counsel until the past week. So that I know that might not be a satisfactory answer to the court, but that's the answer that I'm. I'm forced to give in that regard.
Going back to the meaning of 7433, you aren't conceding that counts 19, 20, and 21 do not relate to collection, are you?
No.
No. Your argument is that there's only a need to bring Bivens claims, if need is the right word, because of the narrow construction of 7433.
The narrow construction as set forth in the Judicial Watch decision, yes.
And in the decisions of two other circuit courts.
Correct, correct. That is correct. So the Bivens deals with that activity that is not deemed to be embraced by 7433.
Of course, that isn't the way that doctrine works. Right? I mean, Bivens is not used, in fact, to fill all the gaps in the statutory scheme.
No, we understand that presents a whole subsidiary list of considerations as to whether this is an appropriate Bivens action or not. If 7433 does not apply, but we respectfully submit that even if a Bivens action has not been recognized regarding Internal Revenue Agent activity that is not expressly connected with the collection, that now is the time to recognize such an action, or at the very least to not dismiss the case at this stage and to remand for.
Assuming all the standing problems are in hand, I'm not sure that we really have occasion to address the exact scope of 7433, because if counts 19 through 21 all in fact relate to collection, then 7433 fits in only in terms of its possible background on the deciding whether Congress has set up a comprehensive scheme that would thrust Bivens aside.
Correct. Your Honor, I notice that my time is running short, and I have not addressed the exhaustion issue, which I believe is a very important issue. Would the court care to hear me on that? The time is running out of the water clock here, but I want to say with regard to exhaustion is that the putative regulation upon which the government rests its, and if I could just finish my yes. sentence, the regulation upon which the government rests its failure to exhaust requirement was enacted post 7433, one. Two, it was not promulgated under the APA, and therefore, indeed, in the preamble of the notice of proposed rulemaking, it's stated as a regulation under 7805, which is an interpretive regulation, and therefore, our position is that that is not positive law, and it would have to be positive law. It would have to be a legislative regulation if indeed that is a requirement under this statute. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gretchen Wolfinger for the Appellees. I'll begin by addressing the Bivens claims, which were brought against the individuals. It's our position that no Bivens claim lies against the individual defendants in this case because there are special factors, counseling hesitation, that is a comprehensive remedial scheme in the Internal Revenue Code that would provide the plaintiffs with adequate recompense for any injuries they allegedly have suffered. I believe that that's the majority position among the circuits, and we discuss fairly thoroughly in our brief all the remedies that are available to the plaintiff in this case.
You didn't mention the 10 deadly sins, did you?
No, Your Honor, and I'm not sure I know what they are.
Oh, really?
Sloth,
I thought
lust,
they were
greed.
Among IRS agents, they're separately enumerated outside the code as misbehavior by IRS agents, which are said in some circles to terrorize IRS agents, but apparently not all people who represent the IRS.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Could I ask you to address why aren't counts 19 through 21 clearly related to collection? I mean, they all fit under Chapter 64, which is entitled Collection. Why aren't these in connection with collections?
Because, Your Honor, there's a distinction made.
Between investigation, assessment on one hand, and collection another.
Yes.
Right? Investigation and assessment is telling us that the determination of the tax liability is not covered by the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. But once it's determined and the government is undertaking efforts to collect, that's right in the center of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, isn't it? And that's what Chapter 64 is all about. And these claims are 19 through 21 are all brought under Chapter 64. So I don't understand why that's not in connection with collection.
Because the cases appear to take a very narrow definition of collection, which is consistent.
Any D.C. Circuit cases?
Not that
I'm aware of. Any Supreme Court cases?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
There are two district court cases, right?
Yes, if I could refer to my brief.
Yeah.
There's a D.C. district case from D.C., and there is a there are two district cases from D.C. There's a Fourth Circuit case and a Ninth Circuit case, as well as a Fifth Circuit.
And were any of them involving Section 6301?
I can't say, Your Honor. I just don't recall.
Okay. Count 20 is a claim for failure to demand payment. Now, what is it about demanding payment that's not related to collection?
Because that's preliminary to collection. You ask, you make an assessment, you demand payment. If the person pays, there's no need to move into the collection.
Not in connection with collection? Oh, that's all we're talking about, is connection with collection. It doesn't say in the act of collection. It's in connection with collection. It's not in, demanding payment is not in connection with collection?
No, Your Honor. I would say not. And also, I think the court should keep in mind that this is a waiver of sovereign immunity. The 7043
right.
permits damages against the United States, so the collection language is being narrowly and, in our opinion, properly construed.
Does it strike you as odd that that Section 6301 then falls within the statutory provision that's under the section called collections, and you're saying it's not in connection with collections? I don't understand that. I understand the need to construe waiver of sovereign immunity narrowly, but it seemed to me Congress had in mind that this was in connection with collections.
I don't know why it was placed there, Your Honor, as opposed to somewhere else in the code.
Might be because it was in connection with collection. It might be.
It might be, but I don't think neither you nor I, with all due respect, could say that that was the motivating factor behind why it was placed there.
Kim is one of a number of cases that all use the same sort of complaint. Are you familiar with those other cases at all?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Some of them.
Because it seemed to me that the Department of Justice or perhaps the IRS has taken different positions about whether this falls within the ambit of collection.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with those cases to that extent.
Well, let me ask you about exhaustion. The court finds that the failure to exhaust, the affirmative defense, is found on the face of the complaint. How is it this apparent from the face of the complaint?
Say that, I'm sorry, Your Honor, you said the court find?
In other words, how
court.
Is it?
Oh, the district court. It was not pled, so it wasn't on the face of the complaint. And further, if I'm understanding your question, and further, when it was raised by the government, plaintiffs did not rebut or in any way indicate.
That's not the face of the complaint, is it? Thompson tells us we have to look to the face of the complaint, right? And it doesn't appear on the face of the complaint.
Yes.
And it's non-jurisdictional, so it need not be pled, right? We're not talking about a jurisdictional issue here.
No, we would argue, in fact, as we did in our brief, that it is jurisdictional.
Well, the Supreme Court Arbonne seems not to think so.
Yeah.
If you're referring to Jones versus Bach, that was a
No, I mean, this case about 10 years ago in which they firmly held that exhaustion is not jurisdictional, and indeed doesn't exist at all unless they're specific statutes or regulations in place demanding it.
Are you referring to either Avocados Plus or ARVA?
No. Unfortunately, I can't remember the.
Okay.
I didn't realize we were going to be hit with a claim that it was jurisdictional.
Well, it would be our position that those cases are, again, distinguishable because this is a waiver of sovereign immunity, which should be strictly construed. And it states in the I'm sorry, are we talking about 7433? Yeah, it states in the statute that remedies must be exhausted before damages can be given.
But that doesn't make it jurisdictional that it states it in the statute. I mean, Arbaugh and other cases require us to engage in more careful scrutiny than that, right?
Yes, except all those cases did not involve a damages suit against the United States, and we believe that they're distinguishable for that reason. Jones versus Bach was a Prison Litigation Reform Act case, and it involved gatekeeper provisions and a fairly extensive discussion under the rules of civil procedure. It didn't involve a waiver of sovereign immunity.
If we disagree with you on whether this is jurisdictional or not, that changes the analysis significantly in terms of this the exhaustion and whether it needs to be pled, right? I mean, if you're right, if it's jurisdictional, then it needs to be pled.
Yes.
And then we could say from the face of the complaint, they failed to do it. But if it's not jurisdictional, you'll concede that it's a much more difficult argument for you to make, right? Because from the face of the complaint, it's not, there's nothing said about it.
No, I think in this case, if the ultimate resolution by the district court was correct, because I was attempting to discuss earlier, it wasn't pled on the face of the complaint, but then in response to a pleading by the government, it was not contested that, in fact, exhaustion had had occurred or any either that affirmative assertion was made or anything attached
well,
to the
plea. Well, then you decided under summary judgment or something, but you don't go under 12b-6, right?
I believe that you could, for failure to state a claim, mm-hmm. go under 12b-6 at that point, where it hasn't been contested by the plaintiff after a pleading by the government. And I believe that's what the district court did. It was not a sua sponte dismissal. She waited for a response of pleading. So I think summary judgment, I believe it would be incredibly difficult for the plaintiffs now, after having a response of pleading, to say that they had exhausted. They're on record as saying they haven't, or at least not putting anything forward that they have. I think it would be difficult to argue oversight or forgetting.
Are you content that standing is present with respect to all 21 claims? Not that it's necessarily present, but that the allegations are sufficient to represent allegations of standing, particularly injury.
That certainly was not raised below, Your Honor, and I think as
you know, we have a duty to consider it regardless.
Yes, you have already mentioned that it's a boilerplate complaint, and I believe the district court was interpreting it broadly. Yes, I understand.
Broadly in what sense?
I think giving the benefit of the doubt that there was, in fact, that there was injury pled, or that there may not be harm, there may not be damages. And also, additionally, there's a question about which I see my time is up shortly. There's also a question of personal jurisdiction if the case goes back, personal jurisdiction over the individual defendants.
Thank you. Mr. Drennan, do you need additional time? We'll give you 1 minute to respond.
All right. Your Honor, again, I think that with regard to this exhaustion issue, important point, the government takes it as a given that there was an administrative remedy, a valid administrative remedy in place that needed to have been pursued in order to have been exhausted, in order to give the Kims their ticket to go to court. That regulation is an interpretive regulation.
But are you entirely relying on the regulation? Because doesn't the statute itself require exhaustion?
The statute itself requires exhaustion of administrative remedies available, and our position is that had there been interpretive regulations in place at the time in 1988 when that statute was enacted, that legislative enactment would have constituted the Congress putting its imprimatur on the interpretive regulations then in place at the Internal Revenue Service. However, this putative regulation that is cited by the government was not enacted until, if I'm not mistaken, 3 years after the statute was enacted. And therefore, in order for that to have been positive law, that statute that regulation would have had to have been promulgated in accordance with the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946, I believe it was.
What did the exhaustion regulations purport to be interpreting?
I believe they purport to be interpreting the statute.
7433.
Yes.
Sounds a stretch to say that you're interpreting a requirement of exhaustion by creating an exhaustion procedure.
Yes, but the exhaustion procedure, Your Honor, respectfully, it's not positive law unless it's promulgated and comports with the APA. There's no carve out for the Internal Revenue Service.
A requirement of exhaustion that was more than just an allusion to exhaustion, and it were interpreted, the combination could very well be completely valid under the APA. But we needn't keep you on this.
I think the court understands our position on that.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted.
Please,